Hey everyone, it's your host Jamie here. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of In Plain English. This is the second episode in a series of short interviews that I conducted last month at the Society for Neuroscience Conference in Washington, D.C. The first episode of these SFN shorts was published last week, and you can find that on the website or wherever you get your podcasts. And there will be another episode of these SFN shorts next week on December 19th. So without further ado, please enjoy these interviews from five early career researchers. In this first interview, I spoke with Eleni Papadopoulos, a DO PhD student at Rowan University. Her research involves using rat models of traumatic brain injury to test whether ADHD drugs like methylphenidate can treat symptoms of traumatic brain injury, like risky decision making. So can you introduce yourself and then tell me a little bit about your poster?
Sure. My name is Eleni. I am a DO PhD student at Rowan Virtua. So I finished my first 2 years of med school, and I'm halfway through the PhD program. So I still got a lot of years left, but trucking along.
Yeah.
So today at SFN, I am presenting my work about how low-dose methylphenidate is counteracting increased risky decision-making following repetitive mild traumatic brain injury in female rodents. So our lab has established a TBI model, and in particular, we're looking at males and females because a lot of people don't look at both sexes. And traumatic brain injury, we know in the clinic, does affect both genders very differently.
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking at both males and females, and we are using a gambling task called the probabilistic discounting task, where the rats are pressing either a small certain lever where they're getting a pellet every time, and the other lever is a large risky lever where the rat will get 4 pellets, but at a decreasing probability from 100 all the way down to 6.25. And we know that a lot of labs study single mild traumatic brain injury hits, but a lot of people don't look at repetitive. And for us, repetitive is important because that's in athletes, motor vehicle accidents, domestic abuse patients, and as well as military personnel. So for us, repetitive traumatic brain injury was something we really wanted to look at. And additionally, there's no currently FDA-approved treatment for traumatic brain injury either. And we know that the brains of ADHD patients and TBI patients actually present similarly, where the catecholamines, dopamine, and norepinephrine are a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, all right, why not use low doses of methylphenidate, which a lot of people know as Ritalin or Adderall, to maybe try to treat some of that cognition that a lot of people experience right after experiencing a traumatic brain injury. So here we're choosing 2 low doses, and we have them undergo a training session with a task, then they experience the 3 injuries, and then they get dosed with methylphenidate, 0.5 mg per kg and 2.0 mg per kg for 4 weeks. So in humans, that's about like a subchronic duration.
Mm-hmm.
So we noticed that actually in males, that with the 0.5 mg per kg dose, there's actually an increase in risky choice. So with the repetitive hits, they're choosing that risky lever with the 4 pellets more often. They're unable to realize, oh, hey, it's not advantageous anymore. Let me pick that small lever to get that single pellet every time. So they're struggling with more hits. And methylphenidate actually makes them worse.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So not great. But in females, we realize that the injury is having a lot of effect on the risky choice. But with 0.5, it's able to decrease the risky choice in the single, but it's still not enough for the repetitive group. So we thought, all right, let's look at the 2.0 mg per kg. And we actually realized it's able to prevent the single and the repetitive increases in risky choice. So we thought, wow, great. So the more hits you get, you might need a higher dose. Maybe one hit, you don't need as high of a dose. And for males, it might not be a good thing to use methylphenidate because they get riskier. So this is the first time that anyone's been able to show that there might be some way to treat cognitive symptoms following traumatic brain injury, and specifically repetitive, and that there's actually sex differences, which is huge because no one in the field has done that. So this is really exciting work. I'm only about a third of the way through of the project. I still need to complete a lot more animals to make sure that what we're seeing is real.
Yeah.
So that'll be the next updated thing. And we're also looking at mechanisms. So we're collecting the brains afterwards, looking at catecholamine proteins and levels, and seeing what the drug might be doing to those proteins as a possible mechanism behind what we're seeing in the behavior.
That's really cool. I was going to ask about a possible mechanism, but it sounds like that is forthcoming.
Yeah, so I've collected the brains. I just got to process them, but I can't process them until I've collected all of them.
And do you have any hypotheses for what the mechanism could be behind the sex difference?
You know, that's a really great question. And I think it might be expression differences in the regulatory protein. So like VMAT2, the transporters, maybe females have more transporters than the males. And maybe that's what the differences are. So I think that's what it might be. It might be the regulatory proteins for how dopamine and norepinephrine are made, packaged, and released into the synapse.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In this interview, I spoke with Nimesha Gerlus, an MD-PhD student at Duke University. Her research is part of a clinical trial testing whether a treatment called transcranial magnetic stimulation can be effective for helping to manage emotional dysregulation in patients across different psychiatric disorders. So, can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Nimesha, and I'm a fifth-year MD-PhD student at Duke University doing my PhD in psychology and neuroscience and planning to go into psychiatry.
That's awesome. I'm also an MD-PhD student.
Okay.
Can you tell me a bit about your poster?
Yes. So, what I was really interested in was characterizing neural networks that are associated with transdiagnostic emotion dysregulation. There's not really a lot of functional connectivity and structural connectivity work in emotion dysregulation across psychiatric disorders. And in some of our previous whole brain analyses, we found the insula kind of coming up as a significant region. So I was really interested in looking at insula networks that might be involved in emotion regulation. So the work that I'm doing is part of a clinical trial that's looking at when you combine psychotherapy and brain stimulation, do people improve in their emotion regulation symptoms? So we do a baseline MRI where the participants generate these really negative autobiographical memories, and then they either regulate or feel emotions in response to those memories in the scanner, and then we stimulate their dorsolateral prefrontal cortex with either active stimulation or sham stimulation, and then about a week later they repeat the paradigm in the scanner. So we had 33 participants at the baseline MRI, and we had 10 people drop out before the follow-up MRI. So the follow-up MRI included 13 active TMS and 10 sham TMS. And I used a generalized whole brain PPI approach to look at the functional connectivity. So basically what I did was we had a whole brain contrast that compared activation when people were regulating compared to when they were feeling their emotions. And then I took all the voxels that were active in at least 10% of people, and I constrained analyses to those regions. So this is a picture of the insula seeds that I used. And then we looked at baseline insula connectivity, and then we also looked at how that changed after the TMS session. And then another thing I was interested in is how those changes relate to symptom improvement and emotion dysregulation symptoms. And so at baseline, what I found was that both the left and the right insula show this increased connectivity with the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex on the right side when they were reframing their negative emotions compared to when they were instructed to feel their negative emotions. And that actually on the left side, this strength of the coupling between those two regions tracked with the severity of their emotion dysregulation. So people who have hyperconnected insula prefrontal regions are more dysregulated. And another thing I was really interested in is we have this cue condition where we cue the memories and we tell them, like, try not to employ a strategy, but this is a dysregulated population. So I was really interested in what's happening when we initially cue the memories and they're implicitly regulating or they're reacting. And so I compared that cue condition to the regulation condition. And I found that we have decreased functional connectivity between the left insula and parietal regions, which you can see here, and decreased functional connectivity between the right insula and postcentral gyrus, which you can see here. And then we also have increased connectivity between the right insula and the right dorsomedial prefrontal cortex. And then after TMS, the question is like, how does TMS affect this connectivity? And we didn't see anything when we looked at reframing compared to when we tell them to feel. But in that emotional reactivity contrast, I did find decreased connectivity between the insula and the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex here. So it's kind of correcting that result that you see there. And then I also found decreased connectivity with the right middle temporal gyrus. And then the final thing that was really interesting was that, and sorry, I forgot to say that all of these results were greater in the active. People received active TMS compared to sham. So it's specific to stimulation group, and it's specific to change from baseline post-TMS. And then the last thing that was really interesting was that we were interested in what regions of the brain are associated with greater symptom changes. And so we found that left insula connectivity with the right inferior parietal cortex here is associated with greater improvement in symptoms from change from baseline in the active stimulation group specifically. So kind of putting all this together, what does this mean? This is actually the opposite of what I expected to see. So there's a hypothesis that subcortical and prelimbic regions have, when you're kind of correcting regulation deficits, you would expect to see increased cognitive control, right? Because you're regulating. And then that's not what we see. We see that it's hyper-connected at baseline. And so I'm kind of drawing on the triple network model where the insulin, I'm thinking of the insula as indicating the salience of cues, like negative cues. And we actually know that the default mode network is involved in self-referential processing, and it can be influenced by things like emotional arousal. So my working hypothesis here is that we have poor signaling between those two networks, which is why we have this increased dorsomedial prefrontal cortex connectivity at baseline. And because we have this decreased signaling, then we have a compensatory sort of connection between the cognitive control system that's trying to downregulate, and we're able to kind of correct that after TMS and sort of increase default mode network engagement by boosting right dorsomedial prefrontal cortex insula connectivity. So this is kind of consistent with some of the TMS work that's been done in addiction. This is actually the circuit that is stimulated. We just haven't gotten there in emotion dysregulation. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to do moving forward.
Yeah, I was going to ask if this could direct sort of future research or like clinical treatment of like depression or other conditions that you use like TMS for.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I really love about what we're able to do is that all the participants have emotion dysregulation and an additional psychiatric disorder, including depression and a lot of other, you know, depression, OCD, personality disorders. So we don't really stratify based on diagnostic groups. So these results would be applicable to anyone who has emotion regulation problems, regardless of what their diagnosis is. So that would be the goal that kind of my what I want to do is target this circuit instead of the one we're currently targeting and see how maybe that's a better choice for this population.
Thank you for agreeing to record yourself doing that.
Yes, of course.
In this interview, I spoke with Hector Arak, a undergraduate student at the University of Puerto Rico and a scholar with the ENDURE program, which is a program focused on increasing diversity in neuroscience. His research is on the effects of an environmental contaminant called glyphosate on anxiety using rats as a model.
And so can you introduce yourself first?
Okay, so my name is Hector Gabriel Halak Martinez. I am a third year undergraduate, and I am from the University of Puerto Rico, Recinto de Río Piedras.
Awesome. And then can you tell me a bit about your research?
Yeah, so our research is basically the effects of glyphosate on the exploration of a novel context. So in general, environmental contaminants have been linked with mental health disorders such as anxiety. Glyphosate is a very common herbicide used in the agricultural industry. It's often found in your food and water. And the literature shows in general that high doses of glyphosate can actually tend to increase anxiety-like behaviors in rats. So in turn, these high levels of anxiety can then impact or decrease the exploration of novelty. So in general, it has been shown that the basal lateral amygdala plays a huge role in the exploration of this novel context. And in this study, we just aim to determine the effects of the chronic reference dose that the EPA establishes. So 2.0 milligrams per kilogram of body weight of glyphosate. So we then examined the effects it had on the exploration of a novel context and just overall cellular activity in the BLA.
Okay.
So first was obviously the exposure. And then after 10 weeks, we did the elevated plus maze. So this was just to assess any type of anxiety-like behaviors. Then after 6 weeks, we did the novel context, which basically consisted of a cage very similar to their home cage, but it was a new cage.
Yeah.
So then we did the sacrifice and tissue analyses. On figure two, we can actually see that glyphosate just overall, the glyphosate group had less time in the open arms in comparison with the control group. And in turn, like figure three also kind of is related to this figure because even though this is in a novel context, we evaluated both distance and time immobile, and we actually saw that the glyphosate group had less distance traveled and more time immobile, which overall just correlates with higher anxiety.
Okay, so in general, this like contaminant, the glyphosate, is making them more anxious.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah, and actually this is, it's pretty, like, it's very apparent because we see it in both the EPM and in the novel context. So in figure four, we actually looked at rears. So rearing is specifically supported rears. It has been shown to be involved with expiration.
Okay, so supported rears, they're on their hind legs, like touching the wall.
Exactly. So it consisted, so it's basically just hind legs. So that's how we define a supported rear. Just stepping on the hind legs, but just pressing against the wall.
Okay.
Unsupported rears was just standing on their hind legs. So we actually saw less rears in the glyphosate group. But when we broke it down, supported versus unsupported, we saw that the difference was in the supported.
Okay.
So it just correlates to kind of like overall lower.
Right. Again, with that like exploration, if you're anxious, right, you're not gonna.
If you're anxious, you're obviously gonna tend to explore less. So on figure five, we actually looked at BLA activity, which it was weird because we didn't see any activity in the BLA. So in conclusion, glyphosate overall increases anxiety-like behaviors in the EPM. It decreases distance traveled in a novel context, but it also increases immobility.
Yeah.
It decreased supported rearing and in a novel context, and it did not affect cellular activity in the BLA. So this, in general, it just suggests that glyphosate causes, in general, increased anxiety-like behaviors, as well as decreased expiration in a novel context, but it's independent from activity in the BLA. For future directions, we aim to evaluate cellular activity in the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis and evaluate the brain for inflammatory markers in general to see if glyphosate is causing any sort of inflammation.
Yeah, that's super cool. So would you consider in the future also doing more direct measures of activity in those areas that you were talking about?
I'm sorry, what?
I like more direct measures of activity. So using like a fiber photometry or like the...
100%. And that's actually, I was literally just talking about with him actually. He's the director of a very big program in Puerto Rico of undergraduates. But we were literally just talking about this. That's kind of the limitation of using CFOS immunohistochemistry. Like you can only just measure activity after they're dead at the end of the experiment. You know, you can't gradually measure.
Right, one time point.
It would be awesome, but of course there's the funding limitations
right,
stuff, yes.
Yeah. This was really interesting. So do you see this having like public health impacts?
I mean, definitely, we talk about it a lot in the lab.
Yeah.
So a lot of these companies are actually focused on like, oh, does it cause cancer? Does it, you know, but they never really measure like, oh, does it cause any sort of like increase in anxiety behaviors? Because even though like that's something that is harder to notice, but it can also impact the quality of life in people.
Right. It can have a really big impact for sure. I think that's something that's really important to study.
Especially when it's like so, you know, easily available in your food and water. So.
Right, yeah. It's, you know, we don't even really think about how many contaminants are in food and water that could be like messing with our brains.
But yeah, thank you so much for, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
In this interview, I spoke with Lisbeth Liquidano-Cortez, a student at the University of Nevada, Reno, and another member of the Endure Scholars Program. Her research used rats as a model to study whether a drug called PN6047 could help reverse the effects of opioid withdrawal.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Lisbeth Liquidano-Cortez, and over the summer I worked at the University of Michigan, and I am from the University of Nevada, Reno. And so for my project over the summer, I were working on the effects of acute administration of PN6047 in an open field test.
So what is the PN?
Yeah, so the PN6047 is a delta opioid receptor agonist that binds to the delta receptor. And PN6047, as you may know, opioid addiction and withdrawal is a huge thing here in the United States, and a lot of people have the chronic use of using it. And so when it comes to the use of opioid analgesics, a lot of symptoms happen that we don't want. We don't want depression, anxiety, diarrhea, stuff like that. It's not something that you want, right? And so the PN6047 is something that we are looking at to see if it can possibly alleviate those symptoms. And as of right now, we're seeing that it doesn't have any other effects, such as like other drugs that have effects like seizures. And so this is kind of like a treatment that could possibly be used instead of other drugs like SNC80. And so we hypothesized that PN6047 could possibly reduce morphine withdrawal symptoms in rats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then how did you test the morphine withdrawal symptoms?
Yeah. So I did 10 or 32 mg per kg of PN6047 along with the morphine. And we did 20 to 40 mg per kg each day for 4 days. And eventually we put them in a state of withdrawal just to see if anything would happen along those lines, if they would get any of the symptoms that we're looking at. And then eventually we would test them and put them in an open field test for 30 minutes. And as you can see here, these are kind of like the results that we saw. A lot of the time in the time and center, along with like the total center quadrants crossed, like, are you familiar with an open field test?
I am, but can you explain it for the podcast audience? Yeah.
So then open field test basically is kind of a test to see if rats or animals in general have any anxiety like effects. And so if they're in the set in the edge right here, that means that it's kind of normal. The rats are okay. They don't have any like symptoms because it's like normal for them to kind of stay in the corners. When they're in the center, it's showing that they're kind of showing exploratory effects, which is fine. It's just an issue if they only stay in the corner and they don't go exploring. That's when we know that they don't got they have anxiety. And so as you can see here, the more we gave them the PN6047, the more time in center that they stayed, you know, in center. And then on this side, the total center quadrants crossed. So we counted how many center quadrants crossed. They were also very high with 32 mg per kg of PN6047. Overall, this is kind of like an overall analysis of the time that they were in. Obviously, the more time they were in the field, the less time they would stay in the center and stuff like that. And the total quadrants crossed were very minimal just because, you know, they got used to the environment. And then 3 days post the morphine, so we're over here. As you can see, the PN6047 treatment really did increase the time in center with the chronic saline and a lot more with the chronic morphine. So that was a good sign, right? And then here with the total center quadrants crossed, the chronic saline kind of did something, but not really, but it did do something with the PN6047. And then with the chronic morphine, it was kind of like the same, kind of not. And then of course we had a little outlier here where he just kind of went crazy. Yeah. And then here, the time center post 13 days. So this is like when we didn't test them for 13 days. As you can see here, the chronic morphine did go up, which is what we didn't expect because we thought that this would go up and then the morphine would go down. And then the total quadrants crossed, the saline did go up and then the morphine went way up, which is kind of, we were like, okay, That means that probably the PN647 worked because it obviously increased their time in the center, but it wasn't significant. We didn't see any significant results from other like trials that we've done.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, you'd first probably need more replicates because I see there's pretty small N.
Yeah. And we only tested this with male rats. Yeah. We didn't test this with female rats or a mix of them. And that's probably what I would have done if I had more time.
Right. Because, yeah, there's, especially with things like anxiety and opioids, there's going to be, like, sex-based effects, right?
There is, yeah. And this was just in a span of, like, 13 days. Right. I feel like if I extended the days of morphine injections, maybe it would have been a little bit more significant. Because 4 days is only, like, 10, 20 mgs per kg, and then the 40 mgs per kg, that's a huge jump and within, like, 4 days.
Right, exactly. So you would want to... I know like a lot of people in the area of research that I do are doing like self-induced like opioid administration.
Yes.
So yeah, that's like a really interesting paradigm.
Yeah, because I was handling them every day, giving them subcutaneous injections, and I mean it seemed to work. I did lose one of them because of it. Yeah. So I did have 8, but he didn't make it to the fourth day, but. Yeah, morphine, you can see, like, the effects in rats, yeah. So,
but overall, like, this was promising, right? Like, the treatment with the PN6047 did kind of, like, make them less anxious,
yes,
which is something you usually see with morphine withdrawal. Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that it did it also in the rats that hadn't gotten any morphine. So what do you think, like, the interaction was there, like, why do you think that it had an effect even on rats that weren't undergoing withdrawal?
You know, that's a good question. I do feel like PN6047 doesn't have any of the anxiolytic like effects that other drugs have, and so I feel like it's just positive in a way where it's not giving other symptoms, but at the same time it's not making symptoms worse.
So
and then eventually hopefully they are working on seeing if this could possibly be a therapeutic for future in combating the opioid crisis. But yeah, that's the overarching.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you for going through that with me.
Yeah, of course.
In the last interview for this episode, I spoke with Lenisa Williams, an undergraduate student at the University of California, San Diego, and an Endure scholar. Her research focused on treatments for PTSD, specifically studying whether having participants engage in a challenging working memory task would reduce their fear responses.
Yeah, so first, can you introduce yourself?
I'm Lenisa. I work in the Risborough lab at UCSD. She does PTSD research. My project is more anxiety and other fear-based psychiatric disorders. Anxiety disorders are notoriously difficult to treat. There's a big treatment gap. And so to make treatments more effective, we're looking to kind of bridge that gap and understand the neural mechanisms behind anxiety disorders and other fear-based psychiatric disorders. And so one of those underlying mechanisms is fear extinction.
Mm-hmm.
So fear extinction is the learned inhibition of retrieval of previously acquired responses. Simply put, it's your ability to relearn that a stimulus that you're seeing that was previously associated with a threat is no longer associated with that threat.
Okay.
And your working memory is a cognitive skill. It allows you to block out task-irrelevant information and hold task-relevant information in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So the thinking is your fear extinction is reliant on your working memory's ability to block out task-irrelevant information or that previously learned threat while you're learning that it's no longer a threat.
Mm-hmm.
The way we tested this is we took 39 participants. We had them do a fear acquisition task where we conditioned them to associate a loud white noise burst with a green diamond here, which is the CS plus, on half the trials. And then they were also met with the CS minus, which is the purple square. From here, they moved into two groups, the working memory training group and the sham training group.
Okay.
And so the way the working memory training group works is that participants are met with a word and then a sentence. Their job is to discern whether the sentence makes sense semantically while also remembering the word that they were shown. And so the active working memory training group, they get up to, the cognitive load goes up to 6 words.
Okay.
Whereas the sham training, it only goes up to 2 words.
Okay.
So you can see there's a different kind of cognitive workout happening here.
Yeah.
And then from here, they move to the fear extinction task, which is pretty much the acquisition task. There's just no white noise burst. and we are recording EEG during acquisition and extinction.
Okay.
And it's a between subjects design, so we're comparing how well the group who got the active working memory training and the sham training, how well they extinguish. We're comparing them to each other. And so what our results showed is that the working memory training did have effect, had an effect on the fear extinction process.
Mm-hmm.
This is all preliminary. So what we originally thought looking at the data is that the effect was positive. We thought those who got the working memory training showed lower fear response or an extinction. But after looking at the behavioral data and kind of just analyzing in a different way, what we think happened is that the group that got the active working memory training had higher levels of anxiety overall.
Oh.
During acquisition and during extinction, just because the cognitive load is so high. It was 6 words compared to 2.
Right.
So it's the equivalent of having somebody run a mile and having someone else do a light stretch and then trying to time them both and seeing, like, you know, the person who does the light stretch is going to do a little bit better. So for the future, we're going to, you know, try to increase the participant size, the sample size, as well as, make the cognitive load a little bit easier.
Right.
For the active working memory training group.
Right. So you can kind of separate out the idea of, like, you're just kind of stressing the people who got the working memory training.
Yeah.
Even more. But you still think that there might be an effect of, like, using your working memory on, like, fear extinction.
Yeah. So it's showing that there is an effect, just not the kind of effect we were hoping for.
Right. Which is still really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, there's something going on there. Mm-hmm. You just kind of have to parse out, like, what actually is causing that effect.
Exactly. It gives us a new question, a new avenue to research. So we're super excited.
Always super exciting. Yeah. So what do these EEG tracings actually mean?
Okay. We're looking at ERPs or event-related potentials. There are voltage changes in the brain associated with stimulus that you're seeing or hearing. Specifically, LPPs are late positive potentials, which are modulated by emotional saliency or emotional significance.
Okay.
So that's what you're seeing here. So that's a little later on the time scale.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to show you the sham training. So the CS plus sham training is this dark purple. CS minus, sham training is this light purple. And we're seeing a big gap here.
Right.
Whereas for the green, we're seeing a smaller gap.
Okay.
And so, like I was saying, we thought this big gap meant, oh, they're not extinguishing. Because if they were extinguishing, it would be a lot smaller, right?
Yeah.
But this small gap, there's no difference, you know, showing that they're probably more anxious overall.
Yeah, they're just more stressed. That's very cool research.
Thank you
for going through that with me.
You've been listening to the second episode of SFN Shorts, featuring early career neuroscientists who I interviewed at the Society for Neuroscience 2023 in Washington, D.C. You can follow along with the posters and find the first episode of SFN Shorts on the website at inplainenglishpod.org. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at plainenglishsci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.